Hi, everybody. I'm Don Land. I'm an alcoholic. Absolutely delighted to be here. I want to get some housekeeping out of the way. First of all, I want to thank my host, Dave, and his lovely wife for opening their home to me. Your kindness and your friendship and your good cheer has not gone unnoticed. You have made me feel very comfortable. I will be moving in after this talk. But of course, we share in a general way in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll probably be more than general tonight. You haven't heard the whole story, so I don't know if you're going to let me back in after this, but we're hoping. But thank you so much for being such a great host. I want to thank Steve for inviting me to participate in this magnificent event. This is really something. And I'll tell you, things like this don't happen unless somebody takes the time to care. And there's a lot of care that went into this evening. It's very evident to me. And I know a lot of people showed up early this morning and started putting this together and that they worked throughout the day. So we could come and enjoy this party because really it's a celebration. You know, we have these little things, these get-togethers to celebrate sobriety. You know, we could just as easily celebrate, gosh, isn't it great we didn't die? You know, but we're here to celebrate this. And I know that after this is all over, and by the way, wise move to schedule the gambling for after the speaker. Very wise. Somebody's been through this before and they go, no, if you do the raffle, half the room goes home. And they're bitter that they didn't win. Then if somebody in the committee wins, they know the fix is in. It's just terrible. So smart move there. And I know that when this is all over and we've gone home, that there'll be people here till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And they'll be moving chairs, and they'll be moving tables, and they'll be making sure that this room is set up for church tomorrow, so when they show up, we reflect well on Alcoholics Anonymous. That they look among themselves, and they go, can you believe there were 400 alcoholics in this room last night? And they'll look at each other and go, that's impossible. And they'll look for evidence, they'll check the trash cans, you know. And the people running this event make Alcoholics Anonymous look good. So I want to take a minute to say thank you for your hard work. And I can always tell when I'm at a good AA event. You can tell by the energy, you know. And there's something I like to do when I'm in a room like this. And I did it tonight. I'll find a corner of the room, you know, where I'm just off by myself. And I'll just be quiet. And I'll close my eyes. And I'll listen to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. No, everybody talking, nobody listening, and just that great energy, that buzz, that hum that we put together when we're all together in the same place at the same time, it's magnetic. And my task tonight is to share with you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today, and I've got a very short time to do that. My wind is long, so we're going to get to it. I don't have a rational explanation on why I'm here tonight. I shouldn't have ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had every opportunity that a young man had to excel at the game of life, yet I ended up in AA more dead than alive September 16th, 1991. I've just celebrated 27 years of continuous sobriety, and everyone, including my gray-haired mother, is very excited about that. My mother wants to say you've done a fine job with her son, and she wants you to know she does not cry herself to sleep anymore because of you. And that's a big deal to me, and that's a big deal to my mother. So we thank you for that in unison. And it's very funny. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about my childhood. You know, I want to get into, you know, my drinking a little bit and talk about what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I will tell you, a wonderful thing happens when you become an AA member. And think about this privilege that we have. We get to live two entirely different lives. Now, I've lived the life of the drunkard, and I've lived the life of the sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the lives are so different, you could set them on separate sides of the room. They don't resemble each other at all. But I'll tell you the other thing that I found that's interesting being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had two completely different childhoods. Isn't that something? No, I'll tell you, I got the childhood that I dragged into Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and it's very tragic. Very sad. Hopefully, if I tell you about that childhood, somebody in this room will feel sorry for me. Which was always my intention when I told you that childhood story. And it's about my dad who, when I was 2 years old, got off of the couch, said he was going out for a pack of smokes, and we haven't seen him since. It's about my mom's alcoholism. It's the physical abuse. It's the poverty I grew up in. It's the gang-riddled neighborhood. It's the boo-hoo, boo-hoo, punctuating my story all the way through. But then there's a story that I know to be true today. Because a funny thing happens when you come to AA and you get a sponsor. And if you're an alcoholic slash victim, and you want to remain a victim in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to tell you, that's none of my business. That is your prerogative. But I'm going to give you some free advice. If you want to stay a victim, whatever you do, for God's sakes, do not get a sponsor. They seem to absolutely delight in destroying victimization, you know? God, the worse I made my childhood laugh the more my sponsor laughed, you know? He didn't interrupt me at a tragic part, go, hang on, let me get my buddies. You got to hear this. It's unbelievable. And I got a sponsor, and he took me kicking and screaming through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got to that four-step and fifth-step inventory process, and we did what the book talks about. We got down in black and white what really happened. And it was amazing the things I conveniently forgot on my way to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had a mother that raised three kids on her own, never took a dime of welfare. Got us up early for school, got us off to school, made sure we were fed, that we had clean clothes on, to go to a, take two buses to work and two buses home to pick us up, make sure the homework was done, make sure we were fed, make sure there was love in that home, there were morals taught in that home. This woman sacrificed her entire life for her children. Yet, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was filled with spite and rage and venom for that woman. That's called a perception problem. And I'm so grateful to AA, the loving God here, and the inventory process in particular that corrected the only mistake I think a loving God ever made in my case. You see, he made my eyes looking outward instead of inward. All my life, I've had that intuitive ability to look out the world and the people in it, and with no effort on my part, tell you what you're doing wrong. And with little effort, I can tell you what you should be doing instead. And I love to share that with you because I'm a giver. I started drinking drunk when I was 17 years old, and I thought I found the keys to the kingdom. I absolutely fell in love with the effect produced by alcohol. And for me, the effect in the word is called relief. It's relief from what swirls around in my head in a sober state. I don't know if I was born alcoholic. There was that big debate when I got sober. I used to hear about that in the rooms. I was born an alcoholic. I developed alcoholism. It's a progressive thing. I don't know any of that for sure, but I know this. I don't know if I was born alcoholic, but I was born weird. You know what I mean? Like half a bubble off a plum, you know, where people would meet me and they'd go, there's something wrong with the boy. You know what I mean? Just. And I have all those precursors to alcoholism. You know, I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm self-obsessed. I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. I'm the kind of little alcoholic, I'll get you in a corner and trap you and talk incessantly about myself for, I don't know, 20 minutes straight. Realize I'm doing it, snap out of that and go, wait a minute. That's entirely enough about me. What do you think of me? And this overindulgent personality, this love affair I have with self, this isn't something produced by drinking alcohol. This is something that diminishes or goes away with a couple of drinks. Diminishes or reduces with a couple of drinks. And I don't know that I'm going to be perfect for alcoholism. I don't know that if you had a bunch of little 10-year-olds lined up and King Alcohol ran his head over the top of them, when his hand came over my head, a buzzer would have went off. You know, this one's going to be strong for the drink. Because it does something for me it doesn't do for other people. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the first things I learned in AA is the definition of insanity, right? And they say, we as a class of people will take the same actions over and over and over again, expecting different results. And I remember thinking about that and going, man, I don't just do that with my drinking. And I thought back, I go, man, first time, clear-cut evidence of that, I was 5 years old, I hadn't even drank yet. Needed a drink, tense little five-year-old sitting in the sewing room, thinking about myself, no doubt, playing with a bobby pin, and I looked to my right, and there was an electrical outlet. And with my keen alcoholic thinking, I ascertained that this looks like it'll fit. So I stuck it in, bam, and I got shot across the floor, and my fingers are smoking, and my hair standing straight up. I remember clearly thinking, did that just happen? Did that hurt as bad as I think it did? Bam! And now, based on the way I lived my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I guarantee you I would have went for three, but I was unconscious. And didn't I do that with my life? I take the vehicle of my life and I hit a wall and I throw it in reverse and I get a running start and I hit that same wall. Like, there's got to be a hole here somewhere. Pain is no teacher for me. Failure is no teacher for me. I just try harder. I have these narratives, these stories that I believe are true, and I put them into effect. And when they don't work out, I blame somebody or something for why I didn't hit the finish line. And I just try harder. And I'll tell you, I get drunk at 17 and all that goes away. All the rough edges become smooth. I fall in love with the effect produced by alcohol. All my life, there's been an invisible wall between me and you. You can't see it, but I can feel it. And I know you're trying to love me, and I'm trying to love you back, but there's something between us that won't let it get through. I have a couple of drinks, and the wall comes down. I start to feel the closeness of my fellows. I start to feel the nearness of my Creator. For lack of a better explanation, I guess I begin to have a spiritual awakening, all because I drank some liquid in a bottle, and it's easy. And I don't get in any real trouble when I'm young. There's no real trouble in my story. Nothing's really going wrong. I'm having a good time. I'm wearing a young man's clothes. I'm going up the ladder in business. I'm dating up a storm. Alcohol seems to be an additive to an already full life. You take anything you can think of, a trip to the beach, a night with a beautiful woman, going to a concert, and you just pour some whiskey on top of that. It just gets better, doesn't it? And I don't understand people that don't drink the way I drink. They confuse me because I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a social drinker. I've seen social drinking. It's bizarre. Half-finished drinks. For God's sakes, what's that about? I got engaged to my beautiful wife, Eileen, who I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. Last June, we celebrated 21 years of marriage and having a very good time. And when I got engaged to Eileen, my family threw us, you know, an engagement party. And there was some social drinking going on at this engagement party. What I call white wine drinking. You know what I mean? Not like pick a fist fight, burn down the car, go through a window, alcoholic fun drinking, but white wine drinking, you know.
Polite, how are you? Good, nice to see you. Glad you could make it.
And we're in the kitchen, my wife-to-be, myself, and my sister Patricia. And my sister Patricia is a social drinker. She has a glass of white wine. And at some point, she saw friends in the living room, wanted to go say hi, and said, oh, there's so-and-so, I'm going to say hi, I'll be right back. And she put her wine down and walked out in the living room. Well, my wife-to-be, Eileen, noticed this. And she looked at Pat's wine and looked at Pat getting further away and looked at Pat's wine and looked at Pat getting further away. And with a little panic in her voice said, Pat left her wine. I said, yes, she did. She goes, well, should I go tell her? And I went, and I said, baby. She's not one of us. At this particular moment, she's not suffering from separation anxiety. So I'm not a social drinker. I'm an alcoholic. I'm the real deal. Not a heavy drinker. Heavy drinkers are confusing to guys like me because they match me drink for drink. But here's the difference. You take a heavy drinker and you call them on the carpet. You go, do something about your drinking or we're firing you. Wife calls them in and says, I love you, but I won't be married to a drunk. Do something about your drinking or we're done. Doctor calls him in and says, you keep drinking in a year, you're dead. Heavy drinker goes, man, I don't want to lose my job, lose my wife, lose my health. Actually stops drinking. Doesn't have to come to AA, doesn't have to get a sponsor, doesn't have to work 12 golden steps, doesn't have to sponsor people, show up early, stay late, make coffee, none of it. Just stops drinking. And his life gets better. This is why we confuse our friends and our family. They think I have a different emotional reaction to that information. You give me that information, here's how I react to it. I don't want to lose my job, lose my wife, lose my health, and I actually quit drinking. And here's the difference. All quitting drinking seems to have long-term effect is that I will finally go so insane in my own mind, I'll either put a gun in my mouth or take a drink of alcohol. That's my menu. Heavy drinker has the power to stop. I do not. See, I have the same understanding that I don't want to live a life that way. This is what's confusing to my family. They're watching my life run out my sleeves. They're watching me go to jail. They're watching me crash cars. They're watching me blow through relationships. They're watching me break promises. They're watching my dreams go down in flames. And they think I don't know it. They think I don't care. And I want to yell at them. Don't you understand? I have a front row seat for the destruction of my life. You're watching it. I'm living it. And I'm giving it everything I got. And I'm getting killed out there. But I'm not a quitter. I'm 25 years old, and the light goes on. For years, they've been talking to me about my drinking, but now the light goes on, and I have what our big book refers to for the first time, with no justification, no rationalization, no story. I have what the big book refers to as self-knowledge. And self-knowledge isn't delivered to you by a family member, or a wife, or a husband, or an employer, or a doctor that's stitching you up. Self-knowledge is delivered to you in your own voice, in your own head. And for me, it was in a dirty motel room at 2 in the morning. And there was all this screaming in the room. And then I realized it was quiet in that room. The screaming was in my head. And there was a voice, and it was mine. And it kept saying over and over again, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. And I remember I got it. I thought, you know, for years they've been talking to me about it. Now I agree with them. And I remember feeling relieved. I remember feeling empowered. I remember feeling confident. Because I knew now that the drink was killing me, and I knew now that I'd be able to stop, and I swear I thought it would be that easy. But you see, I hadn't been to Alcoholics Anonymous, so I couldn't have read your big book. And I couldn't have got to page 39 that says, for the real alcoholic, he will absolutely be unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and reemphasize. To smash home upon our alcoholic readers as it's been revealed to us out of bitter experience. You see, I didn't know that, so I'm drinking in ignorance. And now I'm sober in ignorance. So I'm bringing a knife to a gunfight. I think that I just don't drink and that my life's going to get better. Because by the time I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, like most people, I've been the victim of a successful brainwashing campaign. Don't you remember that? Everybody in this room's been through it. All the people that know you the best and want the best things in the world for you. I don't know if they said it to you, but they said it to me. Things like this. Donnie, you're a great guy. You got a lot of potential. You could probably be anything you wanted to be, go anywhere you wanted to go, do anything you wanted to do if you just quit drinking. You'd be so happy. If you just quit drinking, all your dreams would come true. If you just quit drinking, everything will work out. So I lay my experience across that, and I go, let's see, went to jail, I was drinking, smacked that guy, I was drinking, lost the job, I was drinking, blew up the relationship, I was drinking, yeah, it makes sense. And I very easily blamed the drinking for my problems, knowing that I'm a wonderful human being, and if I could just quit drinking, everything's going to work out. So 25 years old, I take all my strength, all my energy, and I quit drinking. I do not come to AA, get a sponsor, get a home group, work your steps, do service work, none of it. And I quit drinking without you. Thank you very much. For 2 weeks. And I really believe that the tentacles, the muscle of alcoholism, in that short 2 week period, started to flex and started to reach out and started to hurt my family in a new and awful manner. See, because before that, I was drinking in ignorance. You know, my family, unbeknownst to me, was having those backroom meetings where they'd say, what are we going to do about Donald? You know, he's going to jail, he's crashing cars, he's drinking like a fish. And they go, well, when we talk to him about it, he just laughs it off. He doesn't get mad, he doesn't worry about it. I mean, if he doesn't get it, he doesn't get it. But at 25 years old, I make the alcoholic declaration. I tell everybody I know I'm quitting drinking, so don't try to tempt me. And I put the plug in the jug and I just don't drink. And my family's having those backroom meetings about me and they're going, did you hear the good news? He quit drinking. No, he didn't go to jail or nothing. It was his idea. No, he's doing good. He's like 10 days sober. We're seeing him. He looks good. He's going back to the gym. He's showing up at work 5 days a week. Things are looking good. And I don't know, and my family doesn't know what's about to happen, but you do. Because I think it's a matter of willpower. I think it's an information problem. I think that now I have the right information, I have the self-knowledge that a guy like me shouldn't drink, that I'll just stop and everything's going to be wonderful. And I've given my family the worst possible thing you can give an alcoholic's family. I've given them false hope. Because when I looked them in the eye and I said I was quitting drinking at age 25, I wasn't lying, I wasn't in denial, and I wasn't in delusion. When I said it, I meant it, but I didn't understand that there's no room for the truth where the game of alcoholism is played out. So when they saw me drunk 2 weeks later and they said, what happened? I got to make up a story and I got to slough it off. And what started for me was a 6-year odyssey until I made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at age 31. Doing everything you read about in chapter 3. Various vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking. Brief periods of recovery followed always by a still worse relapse. A feeling I was regaining control to find out I had lost even more control. And I do all the classic alcohol. I pull the big geographic. I'm living in L.A., and I know L.A. is my problem. How am I going to get sober there? Everybody knows me. I got that Johnny Saturday night reputation. Everybody wants to party with me. So I moved to Boston. Brilliant. Then I found out they drink in Boston. Takes me about 3 years to wear out my welcome in Boston, and I show up back in L.A. after a three-year hiatus. And I'll tell you, alcoholics, we are amazing people. We are like cats flung out a second-story window. Meow! And we will land on our feet, boom, in a three-piece suit at a job interview, you know? And we get the job. We can get the job, get the money, get the girl. We just can't keep any of it, you know? And I hit L.A., and a week after getting back in L.A., I had the best job I ever had in my life. I mean, not the best job drinking. I mean, the best job to date. And, you know, I did a great job for those people. Then the owner made that fatal mistake. He put his arm around me and said, "Don, I want you to know you've done a great job for us." And I have a translator that lives in my alcoholic head. I don't know if you do, but what he told me was, "You can slack off." And I did. And I stop hiding the drink, and I start throwing the vicious drunks during the workday, and the next thing you know, I get fired for my drinking. And that's not a problem either, because I'm a victim, man. I play the victim card. I call up my sister in Simi Valley, California. I say, "Pat, they fired me. They threw me away after all I did for them. Can you believe it?" "Can I come stay at your house and get on my feet?" My sister said, "You can come stay at my house, but if you drink, you're out of my house, because everybody knows I'm a drunk by this time." And I told my beautiful sister, Patricia, "I won't drink." And when I said it, I meant it. I wasn't lying, I wasn't in denial, and I wasn't in delusion, but I didn't know there's no room for the truth where alcoholism is played out. And I drank every day in that house for 7 months until I got sober. And if you don't know how you do that when they're watching you, well, maybe you're not a sneaky rat like I am. I got no problem drinking around your schedule. I'm unemployed. What time do you go to work in the morning? 7 a.m., bars open. And this is the end of my drinking. This isn't drink so I'm brave, drink so I have the courage to ask the pretty girl to dance, drink so I can make some. This is oblivion drinking. This is light switch drinking. This is get the whiskey on board hard enough and fast enough to shut off your head so you can go into a blackout, so you can pass out in a room you're mooching off your family. To come to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. They sat on the end of the bed. They waited for me to come to. And then in my own voice, in my own head, they made statements and asked questions. "Who are you going to hurt today, Don? Who are you going to rip off today?" "You know, Don, you've taken every good thing that's ever come your way and you've torn it to shreds, and now you're ripping your family off. How's it going to end for a guy like you?" I don't know what you do when your head's like that in the morning, but I just took another pull off the bottle, and I thought it was going to end that way. I get an unemployment check about a week before I get sober, and I go up to my brother-in-law, and I go, "Larry, I got my check. I'd like to borrow your car." And Larry asked me a very strange question. He said, "Don, will you be coming back this time?" Fair question. Because I had borrowed his car a few times that summer and got on a little alcoholic vacations. We know what those are. And the 12 and 12 tells me my outstanding characteristic is defiance. And when Larry said that to me, I got right in his face. I said, "Larry, how dare you? You know, Larry, the last time this happened, I apologized." And Larry, untreated Al-Anon that he was, felt terrible. And he took his car keys out, and I snatched the car keys from this man I'm mooching a room off of to walk out of his house to get in his car. And I remember thinking, there better be gas in it. I went down to the liquor store to cash my unemployment check, because that's where drunks of my type cash are unemployment checks. And while I'm in line, I have what the big book refers to as the thought that precedes the first drink. And for me, the thought's always the same. What's in the half pint? Nobody ever got into trouble drinking a half pint. So I buy the half pint of whiskey. I drink that. It gets lonely. We drink another half pint. And I go, "You know, I can go visit those friends in the valley. I'll be back in 45 minutes. Nobody's going to miss me." And I'm gone. 3 days later, I'm driving up the hill to face that family I'd done over one more time. One more time, I've taken their hope, their faith, and their trust, and I've torn it to shreds. And understand this, driving up the hill to face them one more time, I love them no less than I love them at this very moment. And I love my family tremendously, but I can't serve two masters. I only got time to serve one, and that's King Alcohol. And you get between me and a drink, it's nothing personal. It's almost business-like. I'm getting to the drink. I'll go around you, through you, manipulate you, tell you what you want to hear, but bet your bottom dollar I'm getting to the drink. But you see, I suffer from alcoholism, and I don't even understand what that means, so I can't warn you. I can't say, listen, I have an obsessive mind with a physical allergy. When I drink, I can't stop, and I'm going to drink again because I can't take the pain of sobriety. And I will do this to you again and again and again, although I don't want to live this way. Although I have a front row seat for the destruction of my life, and I'm watching my life fall apart, and I'm watching myself hurt the people I love, I feel like a puppet on the end of the string, and there's nothing I can do about it. I feel possessed. You need to get away from me. You need to save yourself. I don't understand alcoholism, so I can't warn you. So I say things like this: I am so sorry. I did not mean for it to get away from me. I don't mean to treat you this way. I don't mean to act this way. Can you give me another chance? And it got hard for my family to keep giving me those chances as I roared through their life like a tornado year after year after year. I walk into a home that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism to face the heat. I find out an argument had ensued upon my leaving. My brother-in-law wanted to report the car stolen. My sister had negotiated him back to a missing persons report. And when they saw me pull up, they called the police to do the follow-up work. Now, I don't know if you've ever been up for 3 days drinking, but the police usually aren't who you want to talk to. I have warrants for my arrest in 2 counties, so I start yelling at my sister. I got warrants. I'm going to jail. Thanks for nothing, because now it's her fault. And, I go outside to wait for the police because I don't want the interview to go on in front of the family. I don't know what I'm going to be saying. I'm fairly certain I'll be lying. And I'm outside smoking a cigarette, and here comes the black and white. On the side of the black and white, it says, K-9 unit. And I remember thinking, oh, good. They brought the dog, like I'm in any shape to make a run for it. And the cop got out, man, and he's a trained professional. He started asking me those hard, tough questions trained professionals will ask you, like, where were you? And I'm lying, and he's not buying, and he's looking at my eyes really hard because they're rolling up in my head. So I break his gaze, and he breaks with me. So now we're interviewing and dancing in front of the house, And I don't feel good, you know what I mean? And I just want to divert his attention. And I see the dog in the back seat, and I point at the dog, and I go, oh, is that your partner? He says, why, yes, it is. And he walks over, and he opens the door, and this dog gets out. German Shepherd, not a hair out of place, like a Rin Tin Tin reincarnate. And with no prompting on my part, he started to relay facts to me about the dog's life. The dog is past mandatory retirement. They can't retire him. He's too good. The dog has participated in more arrests than any dog in the history of Ventura County. The dog has participated in more arrests and rescues than any dog in the history of Ventura or Los Angeles County. This dog was so phenomenal that the officers took a collection out of pocket where they sent him over to Europe for international competition where he kicked butt on German Shepherds, right? And I said to the cop, I go, that's a phenomenal dog you have there, sir. And this thought flew in the back of my mind, the kind of thought the minute you think it, you know it's the truth. You want to deny it, but you know it's the truth. And the truth was this dog had done significantly more with his life than I had done with mine. I hated that dog. I walk back into a home that's been devastated by the disease of alcoholism to face the heat, and my sister tells me I gotta go. And when she told me that, she was looking at her feet. Years later, I asked her, when you told me to leave your house, you couldn't look me in the eye. Why was that? And she said, I don't want you to lie to my face one more time. My sister asked me to leave. She said, look, I know you're gonna die, and there's nothing we can do for you, but you can't die here. You're tearing us apart. You're gonna cost me my marriage. Nobody sleeps at night. It's insanity. You got to go. And she was right to ask that. And if I had a true partnership with another human being, if I had any true love for another human being, I would have said, you're absolutely right. I would have grabbed my gear and I would have, you know, cleared out. But I'm an alcoholic and I'm not too proud to beg. And I'm telling you, I gave an Academy Award performance. You know what I mean? You can't throw me away. I got nowhere to go. I'm so sick. I'll die. You got to give me a couple of days. Just a couple of days. Please, I'll die out there. You don't want me to die, do you? I'll go to AA and everything. I have no idea why I said that. Zero idea. And it's not that my family believed I was going to go to AA. My first week in AA, my sister drove me to AA and picked me up from AA. You know how it makes you feel when you look the way I look and you get in your older sister's car at the end of an evening of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or she's driving her 31-year-old loser brother back to her place. So, Donald, what'd you learn in AA tonight? You know. I don't remember my first night in Alcoholics Anonymous. They tell me I was there and entertaining, but I have no recollection of it. But I remember my second night in Alcoholics Anonymous because it was the most important moment of my life. If what occurred to me my second night in AA had not occurred, you'd have somebody else here tonight. Because that night in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not look the way I look this evening. I had attended the 6 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. It was an hour and a half meeting. It ended at 7:30. The next meeting started at 8 o'clock. I was waiting for that meeting to start. I had my back against the wall, and I got greasy hair down the middle of my back. I don't shower anymore. I got a full beard with food stuck in it. I'm suffering from audio and visual hallucinations. I've lost the ability to speak the King's English. I communicate in a series of hand gestures, grunts, and clicks. I'm wearing my sunglasses at night. I got my arms folded across my chest, and I'm rocking back and forth, scanning the room. And I'm not doing this because I'm a tough guy. I'm doing this because I feel like I'm going to explode from the inside out, because I'm coming up on 48 hours without a drink of alcohol, and I'm physically addicted to alcohol. And I'm looking at the good members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're clean, and you're happy, and you seem like you've known each other forever. And my head starts talking to me, and it starts talking, look at them, Don. They're not like you. They're happy and they're clean and they know each other and they don't want you here. You notice they're not talking to you, Don? You notice they're not coming up to you? You know, that's because they don't want you here. Why are you doing this to us, Don? Why do you do this every time? You know, you're quitting drinking, Don? How many times is this? 100? 1,000? How many times you quit drinking? Oh, now you're in AA? It's going to be different? Going to be different this time? Who are you kidding? You know what you do, Don? This makes us crazy. You know, you quit drinking, you make the big announcement, and then what do you make it? 2 days, 3 days, 2 weeks, and then you can't take the pain. And then you know what you do? You drink anyway. Here's an idea for you, Slick. Why don't you go get a drink? Why don't we bypass the pain, not play this stupid game? You know you're going to drink again. We all know you're going to drink again. Let's get out of here. Let's get a drink. Let's get a drink. Let's get a drink. And I'm leaving Alcoholics Anonymous on my second night of sobriety because I can't take the pain of sobriety. And I caught a break. And over in the corner were two card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous named Lou and Mark. And it's the most important moment of my life. Whether I live or die is going to be decided in the next few moments because I'm going to go get a drink and it's going to cost me everything. It's going to cost me my family. It's going to cost me my place to live. And it's more than likely going to cost me my life. And I got to tell you, it's a small price to pay if it means it'll stop the madness that's between my ears from going on for just a couple of hours. And although it's the most important moment of my life, for Mark and Lou, it was Tuesday. And Mark and Lou were where they were every Tuesday night between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. They were hanging together, and they were drinking coffee, and they were telling off-color stories, and they were scanning the room. They had their eyes trained on the door and their eyes trained on the room, and they're looking for new men to 12-step. And the way they tell the story is they saw me. And Lou looked at Mark and said, whoa. And Mark looked at Lou and went, yeah. And Lou said, well, I bet we can't get him sober. And Mark said, well, we are here anyway. And they took an action that I believe is the most important action we take in Alcoholics Anonymous, more important than who's speaking, more important than what, you know, the format is, more important than what we discuss at the business meeting. I think it's the only job in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're in the saving lives business. Everything else facilitates that. And these two card-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous took a 30-foot walk across the clubhouse to cordially welcome a man to AA that was dying from the disease of alcoholism. My name is Lou. This is Mark. We don't think we've met you. Why don't you come sit with us? It sounds like such a politeness, such a nicety, and this is why I believe it's so important. 30 feet for Mark and Lou? You expect me to make that journey to them? I can't do it. It's a million miles. Don't you know what I've done, who I've hurt, where I've been? Don't you understand I can't get my eyes off of my shoes? You expect me to go shake hands? I don't have the strength. And Mark and Lou understood the terms of engagement for recovery from alcoholism, that they would have to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffered. And they carried it to me that night. And I sat down on the table with Mark, and Lou continued to stand, and Lou clapped me on the back and said, "Don, this is Mark. He'll be your sponsor." And he walked away. And they assigned me my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that's not done everywhere, but I think it's a pretty good idea in my case. And we say things in AA. We say things to new people because they said them to us when we were new. We don't even think about them anymore. Every meeting I attend, there's something in the format about sponsorship. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. And what do we say to our new friends? Find somebody that has what you want. Huh. I wonder what I want my second night of recovery. Oh, I don't know. Maybe a pharmaceutical rep with a spare Cadillac? It's a beginning. Because I'd have never picked the weenie boy they assigned to me, you know what I mean? Because he's everything I'm not, man. He's clean cut. He's soft spoken. He's bald ahead, wire rimmed glasses. And ooh, he's in love with God. You know that stuff that some people say, "Oh, I don't hit the new man or woman with the God talk till they get their feet underneath them." He didn't get that memo. Our first meeting, man. He's telling me about what God did for you, what God did for them, what God did for him, what God was going to do for me. He's expecting a miracle. He's telling me we're the lucky ones. I'm at the low point of my existence, detoxing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's telling me how fortunate I am. And then without my permission, I might add, he got out a meeting directory and started circling the meetings I'd be attending in Alcoholics Anonymous. How do I know that? He said, "Oh, these are the meetings you'll be attending in Alcoholics Anonymous." And he's talking about AA. He's talking about his sponsor. He's circling meetings. I remember thinking, that's a lot of circling. He stops at one point. He asks me a question. "Are you working?" "Oh, no, I'm currently unemployed." "More circling, more circling, more circling." Gets me a big book, a 12 and 12, hands me the meeting directory, and then he insults me. Because if you're going to sponsor new people, you got to get off on the right foot. Try to insult them as soon as possible. Well, it's impossible not to insult new people. Have you ever tried not to insult a new person? "Hey, how you doing tonight?" Kind of a personal question, don't you think? You know, no matter what you say. And he says this to me, "Do you think you can go home tonight and not drink?" Oh, that's just rude, isn't it? I mean, I'm coming up on my second night of recovery, for God's sakes. And it kind of pissed me off, so I kind of snapped at him. I said, "Listen, buddy, any idiot can go a day without drinking." And he lit up like Christmas. He said, "Oh, you're going to be perfect for our program." Really, that should be one of our slogans. First things first, easy does it one day at a time. Any idiot can go a day without drinking. If you've been here any length of time, you know some days it comes down to that, right? It's not spiritual enlightenment and working with others. It's hanging on to your seat and praying for midnight. Come on, midnight. You know what I mean? Just get through the day. And so it began, and he got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, man. He got me busy in all three sides of the triangle, unity, service, and recovery. He taught me how to be an AA member. Isn't that something? Did you know there's a whole list of rules to be an AA member that aren't conference approved? I did not know. Been handed down for hundreds of years, seemingly, from old timers on wagon trains. I mean, I don't know where they get this stuff. And the way I found out is it seemed every meeting I went to, I guess I did something grievously wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out because my sponsor would be waiting for me after the meeting, giving me that crooked finger. "Come here, Don." I'd be thinking, now what do I do? And he'd tell me what I did. "Don, if you don't like what they're sharing in the meeting, you can't go in the corner and do push-ups. Don, you can't get up and get coffee six times during the meeting. Don, if you don't like what an old-timer says, you can't threaten to kill him and make amends later. Don." It just went on and on and on because it's dog rules in AA. You know what I mean? You don't know you've done anything wrong in AA because I'm not housebroken when I get here. You know, it's dog rules. There's all these rules, and you got to be, you know, and I had a sponsor who was willing to incur my wrath and teach me how to be a good AA member because he wanted AA to stay strong. It was more important than me. He knew if I was going to stay sober, AA had to stay strong. So he knew I had to become not just a guy who could talk about the steps and go through the process. I had to become an AA member. I had to pull my weight here. So he got me taking commitments and doing things in the room that I didn't understand. I didn't understand any of it. What does setting up have to do with staying sober? What does making coffee have to do with staying sober? What does moving somebody's couch have to do with staying sober? Oh, my God. He comes up to me one night. It's 9:30 at night. The second meeting ends. I just want to go home. He goes, "Hey, we're going to go move Smitty's couch. I go, Smitty, Smitty's a jerk. And he goes, yeah, he is, but we're moving his couch. Man, and I'm bitter. We move this guy's couch, man. I'm just throwing his couch around. I'm all pissed off. And we get done, man, and then Smitty rolls off. I mean, worst possible thing happens. You know, he's all humble. He goes, you know, kid, I'm not as young as I used to be. And I couldn't have done this without you, and it really meant a lot to me. I want to thank you. Give me them big AA hugs, you know, pressed him. So I was like, oh, no. Now I can't hate him, you know. Because, man, I have resentments. I'm the Pez dispenser of resentments when I'm new in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? I have a resentment. I talk to my sponsor. We get rid of that resentment. Bam, a new one spring loads into place. I'm like, man, I'd walk up to my sponsor and go, let me guess, who are you going to kill tonight, Don? I mean, geez. I got so bad with my sponsor, he finally wore him out. He goes, that's it. That's it. 72-hour rule. And I go, what's the 72-hour rule? He goes, you bring something to me, I tell you 72-hour rules. It means that you're not allowed to talk to anybody about it, talk to me about it, share to me about it. You're not even allowed to pray about it. You just leave it alone. And after 72 hours, if it's still a problem, I'll give you an action to take. And I'm like, all right, man, you know what happened within 72 hours. I forget what I'm mad at. 72 hours, it takes care of itself. One time I come to him, I'm going to kill this guy. I've got a plan and everything. The whole ambush laid out. I'm going to kill him. And my sponsor goes, 72-hour rule. And I go, come on, man. In 72 hours, I won't be pissed off anymore. And he's like, I'm completely missing the point of the exercise because it's dog rules. Man, dogs don't know they've done anything wrong, and I didn't know I'd done anything wrong until you tell me. Man, I got a dog. I got a dog. Bo the Wonder Dog. He's amazing. 7 years old, smart as a whip. You spend 5 minutes with my dog, you turn to me and go, that's an amazing dog you have there. Yeah, but Bo, like any dog you can think of, at one time, he was a puppy. You know what I mean? And one day I'm on the phone with my sponsees. We'd only had Bo a couple of weeks. He's maybe 8 weeks old, right? I'm talking to the guy, and I see Bo walk into the living room. And I remember thinking, oh, there's Bo. God, he's so cute. I love that little guy. And he goes into a crouch, starts taking a dump. And in the phone, I go, oh, no. And my sponsee goes, what is it? I go, oh, Bo's taking a crap in the living room. He goes, do you have to go? I go, no, man, it's too late. I go, you can't interrupt him. You'll freak him out. You'll traumatize him. No. You got to kind of watch him, keep an eye on him, you know, kind of stalk your own puppy, right? And when he looks like he's about to break bad, you got to grab him. And it will freak him out a little bit because he'll be like, I'm in the air, I'm in the air, I'm in the air. You know, and you run him outside, and you drop him on the lawn, and you step back. And he'll look up at you with all honesty and go, dude, what the hell was that all about? And then he'll realize he's outside, and he still has to go to the bathroom. And he'll go, oh, I'm outside. And then he'll go to the bathroom. When he does that, you better throw a party. You know what I mean? Hooray, Bo! What a good boy! Who's a good boy? And he'll look at you in all honesty and go, dude, you want me to poop out here? I did not know. Oh, I could totally do that, man. I love you. And we do exactly the same thing with our friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they did it with me. They taught me how to be an AA member. Because when I'm new, I come into AA, man, and I crap all over the place. I don't know any better. And thank God for the old-timers who were willing to pull me aside, not embarrass me on a public level, pull me aside and go, hey, man, I remember. I was like that, too. Listen, man, we know you're here, okay? Stop trying so hard. You know what? Why don't you try to fit in? Why don't you just come sit with us? You know, and they brought me into their homes, and they brought me into their lives, and they brought me into their cars, and they taught me how to be an AA member. They're willing to risk my wrath because AA was more important to them than my approval. And I'm so grateful for that they didn't just take me through the steps, and they taught me how to do AA. And they taught me by example. You see, my sponsor didn't tell me what to do in AA. He invited me into his AA life. He left me a little respect. He left me a little self-esteem. He'd say things like, hey, Don, man, listen, tomorrow night I got to set up. Do you think you could be here at, you know, 6 o'clock and give me a hand? And I think, yeah, sponsor needs my help. Sure, sponsor, anything for you. And then he'd tell me, hey, we're getting this committee together, man. We'd really like your input. They'd really like my input. Yeah, it looks like I got here just in the nick of time. And he's taking me through the steps, man. He's taking me through the process, you know, and I have the psychic change, and my life is getting better, and I'm repairing that wreckage, and I'm showing up in courtrooms, and I'm doing the community service, and I did so much community service at the Salvation Army that when I was done, they threw me a party, and I'm doing this stuff, and I'm doing that early sobriety stuff, and I'm 2 years sober, man, and I get a little foot sore, you know, and I got a best friend in AA, best friend. His name's Greg, man. Greg had 30 days when I walked in, right? We became the best of friends in AA. We used to have that death covenant, you know, like, I can't drink, so you can't drink, so I won't drink because you won't drink, and if you drink, I won't drink. We're not going to drink, okay? Is that clear? And we were not going to drink, and we were going to go to AA for the rest of our life together. And we did our first 2 years shoulder to shoulder. And after 2 years, Greg got a little burned out on clubhouse sobriety. He started cutting back on his meetings, talking about the hypocrisy, saying, I don't believe the old-timers walk like they talk. He started having a problem with what he heard in AA. And I started having a problem with it too, to be honest with you, but I didn't stop going to meetings. I just went and checked out other groups, and I found a group. And I found a group that I liked what they were doing, man, and I went back to Greg, and I said, man, I found this group on the west side of Los Angeles, bunch of activists, very, very focused. I go, I think he'd love it, man. It's like the people in the Big Book, shoulder to shoulder, common journey. And Greg says, he goes, man, I heard about that group. You know, that's a group where they have strong sponsorship, right? He goes, man, I didn't get sober to have somebody tell me how to live my life. And I remember thinking, wow, you had a plan when you got sober? Good for you, man. And you fast forward a year and a half, Greg's not going to AA anymore. He's still sober, but he ain't going, man. But I'm going, you know what I mean? I'm going to 5-6 meetings a week. I'm sponsoring guys that don't want what I have, you know what I mean? I'm setting up, I'm cleaning up. I got a real job in the business world. I'm paying off wreckage, man. I owe the IRS $80,000. I got a payment agreement that sent him $100 a month. You send him that first check, and you think, oh, good, $79,900 to go, you know? But I'm going to AA, you know, and my buddy Greg, man, he doesn't go to AA. What happens to him? Oh, man, he's getting promotions at work. He's making all this money. He meets this girl. He knew her from AA. They get married. I'm best man at the wedding. It's like unbelievable. He's making more money. Builds a custom home in the Antelope Valley. Now he's 4 years sober. He's 5 years sober. He's killing it. He's making all this money. He's got new cars in the driveway. What am I doing? I work hard all day. I take all my extra money. I pay off wreckage because that's what we do in AA. We don't declare bankruptcy. We pay the money back. That's what they told me. So I'm paying the money back so I don't need money. And I'm working 10 hours a day. Then I go to AA all night. I give guys ride homes that don't appreciate me. And then I go home and get 5 hours sleep. And I do it again. What a gift. If you want what I have. And I make it to 6 years sober. And man, I hit the wall. I'm so jealous and envious of my best friend in AA, Greg, who doesn't go to AA anymore. And I finally have this realization. I'm the chump. I'm the AA chump. And Greg's got it right. He came to AA, he got sober, he got what he needed, he moved on with his life. He's doing great. He gets off work at 5 o'clock. He's at home in his custom home with his hot wife, drinking and whatever. You know, going, oh, we're sober. We have God. We don't have to go to AA. Good for you, Greg. I'm out all night helping drunks who don't want to be helped. I'm the chump. And I'm bitter. And I'm thinking I'm the fool. And then I got the call. And it's from my first grand sponsor. He told me Greg had been drinking and had reached out for help. And he was asking for me. My wife Eileen and I got in the car and we drove it over an hour to where I used to live and where I got sober. And they had Greg in my old grand sponsor's house. And they had him in the back of the house. And they had him in a bedroom with just one light on. And I went back there with Eileen. And as I got closer to Greg, I knew it was him. I recognized him, but he looked smaller to me. You know what I mean? And as I got closer, he was saying something almost on a loop over and over again. Just saying these same words over and over again. He was saying, is it time yet? Is it time yet? Is it time yet? I pulled my grand sponsor aside. I go, what the hell is that about? Is it time yet? He goes, oh, buddy. He goes, we scooped him up. We can't get him to medical detox till 6 a.m. The first thing he did is he threw a seizure. And we're giving him a half a thimble of vodka every 15 minutes to keep him this side of seizure so we can get him into medical detox. Is it time yet? Is it time yet? And I watched the coolest, smartest guy I'd ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous, the guy that could do anything, the guy I wanted to be like when I grew up, begging for a half a thimble of vodka to say this side of seizure. And I sat down with my best friend in AA, and I asked him what happened, and he told me the story. He said, you know, Don, I came home one night from work, and Kathy and I were in the veranda, and I said to Kathy, I said, you know, Kath, we're not the same people that came to AA. And she said, you know what, Greg, you're right, we're not. I said, Kath, we could probably handle a drink, huh? She said, oh, absolutely, Greg. I said, but Kathy, if we do this, you got to promise me if it gets out of control, we'll go back to AA. And Kathy said, I promise, Greg, we will. So they bought a bottle of champagne to celebrate their new decision, and they poured two glasses, and they poured the rest of the bottle out just to be safe. And then they drank a glass of champagne each, and they waited, and nothing happened. And then Greg said, we laughed and we laughed and we laughed at the old timers. And I said, God, do you feel like having another drink? I don't want another drink. Kathy said, no, I don't want another drink. He said, phenomenon of craving. I'm fine. What's the big deal? And he goes, and they skipped down their merry way. Greg says, 2 weeks later, he came back, and Kathy turned around in the garden, had a can of beer in her hand. And Greg said, what's with the Budweiser? And she said, it's hot out. And he goes, yeah, it is. Do you have another one? He said, you fast forward 2 months later, and we're drinking ourselves to death. We can't stop drinking. The job's about to go. The house is about to go. I can't get out of the house in the morning because I'm drinking first thing. Kathy decides alcoholism isn't her problem, so she goes back on psychotropic drugs, drinks on top of it, has a psychotic break, and tries to kill Greg with a butcher knife. Greg freaks out, locks himself in the bathroom. His wife's trying to come through the door and kill him. He doesn't know what to do, so he calls the police. And when you call the police and tell them your wife's trying to kill you with a butcher knife, they don't send somebody to talk her down off the ledge. They send SWAT. And Greg watched his beautiful wife hogtied in the living room of their beautiful custom home and dragged past their beautiful two new cars into the paddy wagon to go to Sybil Brand Institute to await arraignment on attempted murder charges. And Greg finished telling me the story, and I said, Greg, why didn't you go back to AA? And he said, buddy, we did. But we couldn't catch lightning in a bottle. Because we went back, we got home groups, we got sponsors, but let me tell you what, when you kick 6 years to the curb and you have a bad day on day 17, you just tell yourself you start over. We got Greg into medical detox at 6 a.m. the next morning. At 12 noon, he checked himself out, and I haven't seen my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 25 years. And everywhere I go in Alcoholics Anonymous, including this evening, I take a quick look around the room, and I hope to see my best friend Greg in AA one day. And I hope he makes it back to Alcoholics Anonymous. He paid a horrible price for ignoring the free advice of Alcoholics Anonymous to keep dancing with the partner that brought you. And he gave me a valuable lesson. Never again was I to say, I have to do things in AA. Today I say, I get to do things. I get to sponsor men. I get to go to meetings. I get to set up. I get to clean up. I get to come to rooms like this with people like you and enjoy the gift of sobriety one more day, a gift that for a long time I didn't think I wanted. And then once I wanted it, I knew I'd never have it. I get the honor and privilege of being an AA member, the most outstanding characteristic of my life. I'm running short on time. I want to tell you a quick story, and then I'm going to sit down. 14 years ago, my wife and I, Lean, got tired of L.A. Well, she got tired of L.A. She got tired of the crime. She got tired of the traffic. She got tired of the noise. And she wanted to move to the Pacific Northwest. And all the arguments I had were all about money, you know, which I thought were good arguments. And then I heard myself actually making them. And she chose, you know, beauty and happiness over money. Imagine that. And so we found ourselves in Bellingham, Washington, 100 miles south, or 100 miles north of Seattle, 20 miles south of the Canadian border, you know what I mean? Up there at America's first defense against Canada. And it's a different world, man. I mean, we live 8 miles out of town by the lake, and it's 150-foot trees. It's a forest. I mean, and it's dark at night. You know what I mean? It's darkety-dark. I mean, and I'm a city kid, man. I'm concrete, steel, and glass, and suddenly I'm out in the woods. You know, I remember the first time I had to get something out of my car in the driveway, and I forgot to bring a flashlight, and I got about halfway out to the car, man. A little voice in my head said, cougar. And I just, like, jumped up, and I ran in the house and slammed the door, and I'm up against the door, and my wife's like, what's with you? And I go, darkety dark. Don't go out there. So it took some adjustment, man, and just to the east of us, man, they have these beautiful, beautiful dairy farms. I mean, like from a postcard, just these old 100-year-old barns and these beautiful cows and green grass and pastures. And we were driving out in the county one day, and my wife goes, stop the car. And I stopped the car because this beautiful Jersey cow is like right on the edge of the road. And my wife gets out, man, she's got the camera and she's focusing and she's framing this Jersey cow. And right about this time, this old farmer comes around the corner, his old pickup truck, and he stops right next to my wife. My wife jumps back and goes, I'm sorry, was I in your way? And he goes, no, just want to ask you something. And she goes, what's that? He goes, you do know it's a cow. And my wife goes, uh-huh. And he goes, just checking. And off he drives away. So it took us a while to adjust, right? And we moved there, man, and the first summer comes along, man, and the mama deers are showing up. We got crazy wildlife. We got bear, coyote, wolf. We got everything, man. Cougar, and we got deer. We got tons of deer. And the deer start showing up in our backyard, these mama deers with these spotted fawns, and we're losing our minds. We got baby deer, you know. If anybody needs 20,000 digital photographs of a baby deer, I've got them. Man, and this one baby deer in particular, we just fell in love with this little guy, right? Because he was real rambunctious, and he was real curious, and he was fearless, and this big scar across his face, you know. So I made up this story in my mind about how he defended his mom's honor against a buck or something, got beat up. Right? And so we're city kids, we're naming the deer. That's Mama Deer and Scratch, Mama Deer and Scratch, right? And we're just enjoying our experience and being out in the woods. And then rutting season in the fall comes, and the deer start losing their summer coats and start putting on their winter coats, but not Scratch. For lack of a better explanation or definition, he started to look kind of, I don't know, ugly. He started getting really patchy in his fur and losing his hair. And I said to Eileen, I go, Scratch isn't looking real good. And she goes, no, he's not. And my wife is that girl, man. And she got on the internet and researched it and reported back to me it's an actual affliction that they suffer from in our area. It's called hair loss syndrome. And if the deer get it bad enough, they'll lose all their fur, right? And then winter will come and it'll get cold and they won't be able to eat enough to get their furnace going. And they'll become hypothermic and they'll die. And I said to Eileen, I go, Scratch is going to die? She goes, yeah. And I go, oh, not on our watch. And I lost my mind, right? And we started breaking every Washington State wildlife management law in the books, right? We're doing supplemental feeding, man. I'm putting 50-pound sacks of wet cob into my Toyota Avalon at the feed store. The guy's asking me questions. How many head you got? I don't know. How many head would that feed? Like two? I got two. I'm lying. And when you're trying to feed one sick deer, you can't feed the one sick baby deer. We got deer coming from all over, man. So I got 12 deer in my backyard. You know, and they're knocking poor little Scratch out of the way. My wife, 130 pounds, 5 foot nothing, she's in the backyard chasing out bucks with full racks. You're selfish, you're self-centered. Let the sick one eat. I'm like, these bucks are running for their life. And it's not working, man. It's not working. Scratch is looking worse and worse, man. And I'm obsessed with this baby deer. I'd go to work and I'd call my wife from work. Go, you see Scratch today? She'd go, yeah, he stopped by. I go, how's he doing? She goes, he's not looking good. And I'd shake my fist at God. Not this one, God. You don't get this one. And I'm just nuts. And now it's winter, man. God, and it starts snowing and this stupid baby deer. We have fed him so much, but he's lost all the fur in his body. So all he's got left is a 2-inch wide, 2-inch high swatch of fur that goes from the nape of his neck all the way to his rump, and he's bald everywhere else. He's rounded out like a beer keg. So now he sits in our backyard, this newcomer deer, mohawk wearing, beer keg body, just eating and pooping in the snow. And I'm obsessed with this deer. We're feeding him and we're feeding him and we're just, And we make it to spring and Scratch doesn't die. And for the next 3 or 4 years, in rutting season, he'd come down from the high country with all the boys, and he'd show up in our backyard. And we know it was him because of the scar on his face. And he'd walk right up to my wife, and my wife would feed him apples by hand. And I'd look at that scene, and I'd say to myself, what is it about that damn baby deer that made me lose my mind? And one day it hit me. I'm that baby deer. I'm that guy in the Simi Valley Alano Club with my back against the wall. With anybody with a glancing familiarity of alcoholism would have taken one look at me and said, that guy over there, he's going to die. And two car-carrying members of Alcoholics Anonymous saw the exact same thing, and they said this, not on our watch. And they did exactly what they had been taught to do in AA, and they gave me that spiritual first aid, and they brought me into their lives and into their cars and into their homes, and they shared what had been freely given to them. And I know this as much as I'm standing here now. Bill and Bob are gone, and it's our watch now. And while we're in here tonight having some good food and having some laughs and sharing the gift of sobriety, they're out there in the streets tonight and they are dying. And they are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that funny? They don't even know it yet, but they are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Bet your bottom dollar. And they're coming the way we came. Hopeless, helpless, hapless, looking for something like blind men in the wilderness. They don't know what they're looking for, but they've run out of hope and maybe there's something here. And we have to ask ourselves, when they arrive at our respective home groups, where will we be? And more importantly, how will we be? Am I going to be in the back of the room with my buddies talking about fantasy football, my latest deal, what I'm going to take on vacation, thinking about ESPN, what I'm going to eat when I'm good at home? Or am I going to be like Mark and Lou? with my eyes trained on the door and my eyes trained on the room, looking for new men to welcome cordially to Alcoholics Anonymous the way it was done for me? Am I going to leave all that other crap, all those worldly clamors, all those worship of other things that sometimes are hanging on me when I show up in AA? Am I going to leave them out in the parking lot where they belong, where they should never cross the spiritual threshold of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And remember that it may just be another Tuesday night for me, or a Wednesday night for me, or a Thursday or a Friday or a Saturday. But for some new man or new woman, that might be their last night in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're Alcoholics Anonymous. We're in the saving lives business. I hope we stay sober forever. Thanks for listening.